Good afternoon. It is Thursday, April 15th, 2021, and this is Ozarks at Large on 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. Before we proceed, let's go back to yesterday's noon show and how I started the program. See if you can detect the problem. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, March 29th, 2021. Yes, at this time yesterday, I said it was Monday and March 29th. I said that because that's what I had written on our script. Apologies if you went through yesterday afternoon thinking it was Monday and March. I can assure you today is Thursday, April 15th. And it is not the day your taxes are due. We have a pandemic-inspired month's delay regarding that task. What we do have this afternoon is a conversation with Reverend Nancy Frausto, Associate Rector at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Long Beach, California. This weekend, she'll deliver two talks, virtually, as part of the Tippi McMichael Lecture Series sponsored by St. Paul's in Fayetteville. Her take on how the church has changed and why it should change after a year of a pandemic is ahead. And in our second half hour, Leah Uribe brings us a new edition of Sound Perimeter, exploring a campaign to include greater diversity in new music. After Ozarks, on Here and Now, Major League Baseball honors Jackie Robinson, the man who broke the game's color barrier. And Robinson's life offers a lens to view our current racial reckoning. Plus, the afternoon's news from around the world on Here and Now, today at 1 on KUAF. A bill that would prohibit Arkansas from implementing any form of requirements for a vaccine passport has passed its first legislative hurdle. The Senate Public Health, Welfare, and Labor Committee, by a voice vote yesterday, advanced Senate Bill 615. Under the legislation, the state, a state agency or entity, a political subdivision of the state, as well as any state or local official, would not be able to require an individual to produce documentation that they have been vaccinated for COVID-19. In presenting his bill to the committee, Republican Senator Trent Garner of El Dorado said he thinks everyone should be vaccinated, but he doesn't believe the government should require it. Representatives from the Arkansas Department of Health spoke against the bill, including Laura Hsu, general counsel for the department. She said the department is concerned about the lack of definitions in the bill. The legislation now goes to the full Senate for a vote. A similar bill that would have prohibited the mandating of COVID-19 vaccines in order to enroll in a school or early learning center as a condition for employment or in order to obtain a license failed in a House committee last week. The Arkansas Department of Health reports 220 new diagnoses of COVID-19 in Arkansas during the last 24 hours and 7 additional deaths from the virus. Both active cases and hospitalizations increased during the last 24 hours, 52 more active cases, and 7 more hospitalizations. The first of 2 major vaccination clinics in Northwest Arkansas is underway today. Designed for people seeking a first shot of the Pfizer vaccine, the clinics do not require a fee, insurance, or a Social Security number. Today's clinic is taking place until 4 at the former Sears Center in the Northwest Arkansas Mall. Tomorrow's begins at 8 and lasts until 1 at the J.B. Hunt headquarters in Lowell. Registration can take place at nwacouncil.org/nwavaccines. And as of this morning, there was room for as many as 2,000 walk-ins for shots. The city of Fort Smith's plan to lease the Blue Lion facility on 2nd Street in downtown Fort Smith will be paid for through money split from 5 city funds. Talk Business and Politics reports the $118,000 for the lease will come from the city's general fund, street sales tax fund, street maintenance fund, water sewer operating fund, and solid waste fund. The Blue Lion has been used by the University of Arkansas Fort Smith for several years as an entertainment venue. The city plans to use the downtown space primarily for board and commission meetings. An Arkansas music festival is returning after 2 years. The King Biscuit Blues Festival announced its 2021 lineup yesterday. The 35th annual event in Helena will include Mavis Staples and Billy Branch and the Sons of Blues with Bobby Rush. The festival is scheduled for October 6th through 9th. More information at kingbiscuitfestival.com. And the number 1 Arkansas Razorback baseball team heads into a weekend series with Texas A&M after flexing some power yesterday against Arkansas Pine Bluff. The Razorbacks, who as a team lead the country in home runs hit, hit 8 more in yesterday's 26-2 win over the Golden Lions. Arkansas's first game against A&M is scheduled for a 6:30 first pitch at Baum Stadium Friday night. And oh, by the way, the Arkansas softball team is second in the country in home runs hit. This is Ozarks at Large. A team of Hendricks College professors and students have calculated that rehabilitating abandoned fracked natural gas and oil field sites can yield valuable environmental and social returns. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with three scientists about that research, research that was published last month in the journal Nature Sustainability.
The article, Ecosystem Services Benefits from the Restoration of Non-Producing U.S. Oil and Gas Lands, makes a clear case for rehabilitating spent U.S. fossil fuel extraction sites. Maureen McClung is an associate professor of biology at Hendricks College, one of six authors at the college who collaborated on the paper.
And when you think of an oil field with pump jacks moving up and down, like the classic kind of Texas oil field, you're thinking of a conventional oil field. Over time, these pools of fossil fuels are depleted and production declines. However, in the last couple of decades, unconventional drilling has been on the rise because it can revive some of these areas where production has declined. And this happens because it involves not just vertical drilling, but also horizontal drilling. Unconventional extraction also involves using high-pressure water with chemicals and sand to break open these formations to release oil and gas. And this is the process that is known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. So unconventional techniques have allowed for production to increase in these previously developed oil fields that have become less productive. But then they've also allowed for us to expand into new areas where geological deposits were previously inaccessible.
The most productive fracked fossil fuel fields currently are the Permian Basin spanning West Texas and New Mexico, and the Marcellus Shale, a natural gas play spanning parts of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. Co-author Matthew Moran is a professor of biology and health sciences at Hendricks College.
While the U.S. does export some oil, it remains the largest net importer of oil in the world at over 6 million barrels per day. So while we are the largest oil producer of oil, we are also the biggest consumer of oil. Because of the unconventional drilling boom, the U.S. has become a net exporter of natural gas. We produce slightly more than we consume, but Russia is still the largest gas exporter in the world.
Unconventional fossil fuel companies' first prospect for profitable underground reserves, then purchase extraction leases from private landholders or pay public and state landholders for permits to frack for natural gas and oil. William Hayden Champosi, an assistant professor of economics and business at Hendricks College, is lead contributing author.
The thing about these non-renewable resources is that as we continue to pump them out of the ground, even with hydraulic fracturing, they'll eventually run out. But the well infrastructure that was used to extract those resources, that sticks around. And in particular, it sticks around preventing the restoration of the ecosystem.
This is Maureen McClung. The type of disturbance on the landscape includes complete conversion of ecosystems like forests and grasslands and deserts to gravel well pads. There are also roads and pipelines built to service these well pads. Then there's all this other supporting infrastructure like noisy compressor stations, which help pressurize the fossil fuels to move it through pipelines. And there's also ponds that hold frack water. So we're not just talking about a few patches of disturbed land here, but a network of disturbance caused by conversion, modification, and fragmentation of ecosystems.
A case in point is the Fayetteville Shale, a 5,800 square mile unconventional natural gas play first developed in the summer of 2004 by Southwestern Energy Company in north central Arkansas in Conway County. Prospecting, drilling, and fracking for natural gas aggressively expanded to surrounding counties up until 2016.
Yes, this is Matt Moran. In fact, it's a dry gas field and because the U.S. has produced so much natural gas in recent years, that's resulted in very low prices for the resource. So the Fayetteville Shale never became very profitable. And many wells have already gone dry.
Certain divested industries left behind wastewater retention ponds containing hazardous chemicals, various holding tanks, and wellheads, which can't produce what's called fugitive gas emissions.
Wells that have been abandoned and not been reclaimed and restored have the potential to leak methane. Some of them don't. Some of them do. If they're properly plugged after they are abandoned, then they should not leak. But we do know that there are thousands of wells in the U.S. that currently leak methane.
The team calculated the value of ecological services. Purification of water and air, for example, provided when 2 million acres of defunct fracked oil and gas lands are restored.
This is William Hayden Champosi. So there is some degree of restoration in the United States, and we've focused on the wells that have not gone through that restoration already. And there are many, many of those wells, 430,000 of them is what we look at in our study. We focus on the benefits of the value of crops or trees that could be grown on the land that is currently being affected by the well and its infrastructure. The crops provide economic benefits from food production and supporting our food system. And the trees, those can absorb carbon dioxide, which create a benefit in that they can help us avoid some of the catastrophic consequences of climate change into the future. So whenever we put these kind of values into our models, we're able to come up with a dollar value of the total benefit of that restoration. And it comes up to about $21 billion. When we compare that to the cost of just restoring these sites, because that does have a cost to it, the cost that we estimate is only $7 billion.
But who will conduct and pay for restoration of abandoned fossil fuel fracked sites on private or public lands is the million-dollar question.
This is Maureen McClung. There is not really centralized regulation or strict or transparent regulation for how restoration should proceed when a well is abandoned. And there's a lot of variation in the practice from state to state because there's no federal oversight. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of accountability here for ensuring that abandoned wells are restored. Now, the oil and gas companies are required to put down well bonds, which means some money is set aside for restoration, but rarely is it enough money to cover the full cost of restoration.
In late March, the Biden administration released a $2 trillion infrastructure and climate plan funded by corporate tax hikes. The plan includes a mandate to, quote, put the energy industry to work plugging orphan oil and gas wells that pose serious safety hazards while causing ongoing water, air, and other environmental damage. Biden's plan includes an immediate upfront investment of $16 billion that will put hundreds of thousands to work plugging oil and gas wells. But no mention is made in the plan about rehabilitating fracked landscapes. Maureen McClung says no centralized oversight exists to clean up and restore such sites.
So we recommend that there should be a system for actually providing adequate funding for restoration, whether this involves taxing the gas companies more. It remains to be determined. But we also recommend that, you know, there should be some more centralized oversight into whether or not this is actually going on, maybe thinking at the federal level and providing the support with specialists who know about ecological restoration so they can make recommendations for the right type of habitat to restore to and help with monitoring to ensure that it happens.
William Hayden Champosi hopes their research findings will spur stakeholders to take action.
That local and national lawmakers, landowners, conservation groups, you know, really recognize this opportunity and come together to take action on this. We really view it as a win-win, right? The benefits go to all of society.
You can find a link to the abstract for ecosystem services benefits from the restoration of non-producing U.S. oil and gas lands, published in Nature Sustainability, on our news page. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The city of Fayetteville will host a pair of ceremonies tomorrow to unveil Nolan Richardson Drive and the new Leroy Pond Avenue. The first event at 2 takes place at the University of Arkansas Gardens. That will be the dedication of Nolan Richardson Drive. At 3:30, city officials will travel to the Fayetteville National Cemetery for the Leroy Pond unveiling. Both events open to the public. Both will require mask wearing and social distancing. Art Ventures is showcasing new work in its exhibition, Latina Stories, Abstraction and Expression. This will last through May 30th. The work of three artists from Peru, Brazil, and Colombia featured in the gallery at 20 South Hill Avenue in Fayetteville. More details, including gallery hours, at artventures-nwa.org. And this week on the TED Radio Hour on KUAF, recessions, depressions, bubbles, blue skies. Our economy has a history of soaring and plummeting. Sunday, TED speakers look to the past for lessons on building a more stable financial future. The TED Radio Hour, Sunday afternoon at 1 on 91.3 KUAF.
KUAF is supported by Arcega's drive-thru location at 1509 MLK in Fayetteville. Open 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. with a full coffee menu, espresso options, seasonal drinks, and a small foods menu. Arcegas.com or Facebook for more. The 45th annual Hogeye Marathon is Saturday, April 24th and 25th in downtown Springdale. This full and half marathon, 5K and 10K run, plus four-person marathon relay will benefit several local charities. Finisher medals will be awarded. The online registration deadline is April 22nd. HogEyeMarathon.com for information.
This is Ozarks at Large. We continue to navigate how to try to return to customs and routines affected by the pandemic. This weekend, St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville will host a pair of talks from the Reverend Nancy Frausto about how the church might serve in a post-pandemic world. She is Associate Rector at St. Luke's in Long Beach, California, and will deliver her talks virtually Saturday evening at 7 and Sunday morning at 10 as part of St. Paul's Tippi McMichael Lecture Series. Yesterday, we reached her by Zoom and asked her how she thinks the church should respond to this past year.
All faith communities have a responsibility of continuing the work of being the church and not getting too comfortable in going back to the way things used to be and being inside a building. I think one of the biggest opportunities we have now as we start thinking about, some sort of normalcy is that, yes, we get to go back into our buildings, but in this last year, we've also learned that the building is not the church. It's the community. So our huge responsibility is going to be continuing the work that we have been doing in the last year in a way that it's authentic and in a way that it's moving the church forward and not backwards into a comfort zone.
Yeah, that's interesting. What have the last 12, 13, 14 months been like for you and your congregation?
Well, there's been good days and there's been bad days. Mm. if we're being honest, I think that in the last 12 and 14 months, one of the things that my congregation did is that we weren't blind to the challenges, but we were excited to look at the opportunities that came with those challenges. So, a church that had never, ever thought about broadcasting or going live, is now going live, not every single Sunday, but in every other opportunity. We're thinking about different ways of doing formation, different ways of being present within the community. So while there's definitely been lost anger and frustration, there's also been a multitude of blessings that have come because the community has come together in a very special way. A way that all communities should come together in a time of difficulty.
Yeah, I think about a year's time, that's Christmas, that's Easter, that's birthdays, that's funerals, that's the entire liturgical calendar that has been done not the way it had been done years, decades before.
Right. Well, it's funny enough that you say that because the first Holy Week, right when the whole country went into lockdown, right? As we started thinking, how do we do this digitally? Questions that we've never had. I mean, I'm a millennial, but I wasn't like a super techy millennial. So I knew the bare basics. But it's like, how do we do this in a way that it's still holy? That you're not just putting on a show, right? Like, you don't want to put on a show. you want to worship, you want to be in community. So learning to do all of that was, you just had to do it quick and go with it. And one of the things that has been a big lesson for myself and other clergy that I've spoken to is that we've learned to like let go of perfection and realize that you just need to trust that if your heart is in the right place and you are worshiping God, like everything could go wrong and it can still be beautiful because you are doing it in a way that it's not about your ego or about the community looking good. It's about God, which should have been the beginning, you know, should have been that way from the very beginning. So yes, it's been really exhausting and really beautiful.
I think I know that you want some things that have changed in the last 13 or 14 months to change. Do you think, and I guess this is more of a general, but I'll ask it in a general sense and in a specific sense for your congregation. Do you think church, houses of worship have been altered somewhat in some degrees permanently because of the last year?
Yes, I do. And I truly hope they have changed. If we haven't changed after a year of a pandemic and social upheaval, what's going on? Like, I would question why we haven't changed. And this is no judgment on anything or anyone. It's just that after a year of the open wounds of our country just being completely exposed, if we've been blind to them, that means we haven't been paying attention. And that means we haven't been paying attention to the people in our pews who are hurting. So yes, I think the church and all faith communities really have had needed to change and be transformed in a new way, which kind of, I don't know if this is going to make sense, right? But this last 14 months have really pushed us into going back to what originally the church was. It was a gathering of believers, of scrappy believers. It wasn't about the pretty vestments or the liturgy. It was like, let's just get together and be with one another. So I hope that as the church, as we continue to have more freedoms to be outside and worship with one another, that we can continue holding dear those things that have been sacred for generations. And we have kind of forgotten about it because we've gotten comfortable.
Have you talked with other priests or other faith leaders in other denominations about what the year has been like? And what have those conversations been like?
Well, everybody's been exhausted. nobody had been prepared to become director, producer, editor. But you know, we've had to learn quickly. So yes, I mean, I think the first part of the conversation is everyone has been exhausted. And once we get past the exhaustion, I gotta say, there's been a couple of us who have really looked at this time as a time of creativity. You know, in the Episcopal Church, we have the Book of Common Prayer, which, you know, it's a guide to our liturgy, and it's beautiful. And it doesn't necessarily translate that well when you're trying to be a digital church. So we had to be a little bit creative. How do we explore the beauty and tradition of our liturgy in a way that someone that just happens to have, you know, been friends with someone who liked our video sees it and says, huh, that's interesting. Like someone that would have never walked into a church can now like watch, hear the preaching, hear the music, and be transformed with it, right? Like God has been part of all of this forever. And God is working in people's hearts in a way that we don't know. But now we have an opportunity for people to get a glimpse of what the church is about. And again, the church is much more than the pretty vestments and the liturgy and the building. You know, the church is the people. How are the people showing up for one another? So I think other clergy people that we've had these conversations, it's also giving us a liberty to be a little bit more creative. In this time.
I'm when we get out of this, when we're done with the virus, whenever that happens, and I guess we still don't know, so much else challenges us. I mean, as you mentioned, this past year has laid raw some of the great challenges this country faces, be it economic, be it social. We had the death of George Floyd and other deaths. We had an election that stripped us raw. I mean, when the virus is done, the church is still going to be leaned on by so many people.
Well, and one of the things that I've been really thinking about and wrestling with is this idea that, you know, for Christians, for people who call themselves, you know, people of the resurrection, when Easter comes, when the resurrection happens, typically as Christians, we are like, yeah, celebration. We, you know, we have a huge party and we're looking forward to that. But the thing is that the actual first Easter, the moment of resurrection, it didn't magically change things for the disciples, right? They were still afraid of the authorities. They were hiding. There was so much fear. I think for us, as we move out of this pandemic, there's still going to be some of that fear that happens. And it's going to be really important for us to remember that just because the pandemic is gone, just because the resurrection happens, doesn't mean things have come to a solution. You know, I'm such a priest. One of the things that I look at in all the resurrection stories in scripture, when Jesus appears to the disciples, he always mentions the wounds. The wounds are always present. We get Doubting Thomas, you know, we get the Road to Emmaus, and the wounds are a big part of those stories. And that to me reminds us, death happened and there's proof of that pain, of that suffering. And just because Jesus comes back doesn't mean that that suffering is gone. It's still present. It's still something that we need to deal with. As we come out of this pandemic, there is a lot of issues that have been exposed that as the church, we need to make sure that we are talking about them and being part of the reconciliation and of the solution, of the conversation, of bringing people together. We have to talk about the inequality that has happened in healthcare, in economics, what communities have been affected the most and why. You know, we cannot just pretend everything is back and perfect because it's not. That is a lie. And the church should not be in the business of selling lies.
You know, because of all of that has happened, even in a non-pandemic year, people go through loss and grief. And one of the things that is part of the relationship between a congregant and their priest or their imam or their pastor or whatever is a touch, a hand on a shoulder, a hug. That hasn't happened for you or your congregants. How challenging has that been for you and the people who might look for that touch from you?
That's definitely been one of the biggest challenges. We've had a couple of people in my congregation lose family members to COVID. And one family in particular lost two brothers in a matter of days. Not being able to be present with them and give that hug that lets you know everything will be okay, that you are not alone, that the pain is there, but we're here with you. That has been one of the most difficult moments in my ministry this last year, because as you said, it's such an important part of pastoral care, of just being with one another, that touch. But I will say that even though we haven't been able to have those moments, there's been moments when prayer has been even more powerful, because we cannot feel each other like hugging one another, but we can feel the presence of the Holy Spirit in that moment as we pray with one another. And it's not just about the priest praying for the layperson. It's brothers and sisters in Christ praying for one another. So yes, I mean, I can't wait to the moment where we can spend 15 minutes during the piece hugging one another and crying. I'm looking forward to that moment. And yet, even though we can't do it, there's this evidence that love is present because God is present.
Reverend Nancy Frausto is Associate Rector at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Long Beach, California, and she will give a pair of talks virtually this weekend as part of St. Paul's Episcopal Church Tippi McMichael Lecture Series. The first talk is scheduled for Saturday night at 7. The second is set for Sunday morning at 10. You can find out more and find links at stpaulsfay.org/tippi. That's stpaulsfay.org/tippi. We talked with her yesterday afternoon via Zoom.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Today we will hear from Ray Hanley, who is the CEO for the Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care, to discuss COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy and how it can improve. No doubt the reluctance towards getting the shot escalated this week when the FDA and the CDC recommended that states pause the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. They are reviewing data involving 6 reported cases of a rare and severe kind of blood clot in people who got the J&J vaccine. All 6 cases occurred among women 18 to 48, and symptoms occurred 1 to 2 weeks after their vaccination. Nearly 7 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have been administered in the U.S. Governor Asa Hutchinson said Tuesday the J&J distribution pause is no reason to not get a vaccine, adding that the state is in a race to avoid another surge in COVID cases. Before Tuesday, 3 vaccines were being administered in the U.S., with the J&J shot being the only one-shot dose. The Moderna and Pfizer vaccines require 2 doses. After the break, Ray Hanley with the Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care. You're listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
The World Health Organization describes vaccine hesitancy as the delay in acceptance or refusal of vaccines despite availability of those services, and is influenced by factors such as complacency, convenience, and confidence. And that's kind of the point we've reached in this COVID-19 pandemic. Arkansas has fully vaccinated 18.3% of its population, according to a recent New York Times COVID-19 vaccine tracker, and that is only better than 3 other southern states, Alabama, Georgia, and Tennessee. In a recent interview, Roby Brock discussed the topic with state health official Ray Hanley, who is the CEO for the Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care.
But if you look across the spectrum and some of the polling and you see some of the, you know, patterns here, obviously the hesitancy is higher in the South. Southerners are least likely to want to get vaccinated. The Northeast is the most likely. The PBS Marist poll here last week said 50% of Republican men don't plan to get vaccinated, 90% of the Democratic men. If you look, white evangelicals are less likely to want to get vaccinated. The rural population is more of a challenge. Blacks and Hispanics are less likely to want to get vaccinated. If you try to analyze some of the reasons, knowing that the vaccines are how we're going to get beyond this, we have to get to herd immunity to put this behind us, which is 70 to 90.
So what are some of the reasons why we're finding out that some people are not willing to do this? Is it lack of education? Is it distrust of government? Is it pure politics in terms of?
It is all of that, Roby. If you look, for instance, at the evangelical community, what comes up often is, well, it's got aborted fetal tissues in it. And we're not going to take it. Well, years ago in the development, that was true, but it's not true in the vaccines now. Pope Francis has said it's morally acceptable to vaccinate. A lot of the ministers have. I actually saw a white evangelical minister the other day somewhere. He said the slogan needs to be "Love thy neighbor, get the shot," which I thought was helpful. And it's going to take a lot of the faith community to get involved in this, I think, particularly in rural areas. And then another common reason you hear is, well, it can't be safe because it was developed just too fast. And the reasons, the research for this goes back years. I mean, this is not new research. This RNA science and uses the body's natural defense mechanism is science that goes back years. It was developed fast, of course, because there was a lot of money thrown at it, and the companies worked hard. And frankly, President Trump, he deserves a lot of credit for the Operation Warp Speed. I mean, he challenged the companies and put a lot of money into it. You've got, the idea, you're going to get a Bill Gates microchip. That's one of the best ones I've heard. And then the isolated adverse reactions to the vaccines have gotten pretty well blown out of proportion. I listened to local talk radio yesterday going home, which was completely out of control. And the whole story went on for 15 minutes about somebody in Florida. They got a shot and all their skin peeled off. And if you listen to the reaction to that, you'd think, 50% of the people that get a shot, they lose all their skin.
So there's lots of things that work there. The one that gets me is the one about the chip that's going to get implanted when
you're carrying a cell phone.
We've all got these cell phones that can follow you anywhere right now. So
they certainly can. I mean, my wife knows where I am 24 hours a day if I put my phone.
Well, you guys are out in the field working. You're part of the Vaccinate the State effort that's out there. You're also doing a lot of clinics on site in different areas around the state. What are you experiencing from the people that are coming in and where they have some hesitancy?
There were some. And one of the ways we overcame that in a big event we did at Searcy, where I think we did about 900 people one day, is we partnered with the residency program at Unity Health. And while we had the nurses and the clinical personnel, they sent over residents to help in the clinic. And you had these white-coated physicians that were there to answer questions and visit with the people after they got their shots or before if they had questions. And that helped. And some people showed up with questions and some hesitancy. And once they were able to talk to one of the clinical people, we were usually able to overcome that.
So clearly some grass tops type leadership is going to be important for this. So in local communities, voices that people trust.
It is. And again, the preachers, they need to get involved. And particularly, I think it'll be helpful in the Black community. Some of the ministers have already weighed in. I think that will help. If former President Trump would weigh in, would do a PSA, I think that would help as much as anything.
Hanley also said that there is growing evidence that COVID-19 vaccines may become an annual affair, just like that yearly flu shot. In other news this week, Arkansans have purchased nearly 43,000 pounds of medical marijuana since the first dispensary opened in May 2019. Bentonville's Relief Center leads the state, selling about 4,600 pounds since it opened in August 2019. And a bill that would raise hunting and fishing license fees in Arkansas is being considered at the state capitol. Arkansas Game and Fish Commission Director Pat Fitz told a House committee that fee increases are necessary to keep pace with infrastructure improvements. Fishing licenses for Arkansas residents have been $10 since 1984. Hunting licenses have been $25 since 1990. And wealth management company Prime Capital Investment Advisors of Overland Park, Kansas, expanded in Northwest Arkansas recently when it closed a deal to acquire Fayetteville firm Sphere Wealth Management. Prime Capital entered the market 2 years ago when it bought Fayetteville firm Longer Investments. You can find all those stories and much more online at nwabusinessjournal.com. I'm Paul Gatling, and that is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. Oklahoma State Department of Health this morning reporting 300 new cases of COVID-19 during the most recent 24 hours of testing. The state also recorded 21 additional deaths from the virus. A possible candidate for the Republican Party nomination for president is scheduled to be in Arkansas later this spring. It was announced this morning South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem will be the keynote speaker for the 2021 Reagan Rockefeller fundraising dinner in central Arkansas on June 4th. Tickets for the event range from $250 to $2,500. Saturday morning, Lake Dardanelle State Park will explore the history of the Trail of Tears in Arkansas. A park interpreter will discuss the role the land in and around the state park played in the forced removal of native populations. This begins at 9 Saturday morning at the park's amphitheater. More information available at arkansasstateparks.com.
Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. We opened our segment today with A Bridge Between Starshine and Clay by American composer Intifigis Visueta, a non-binary Quechua Latinx composer from Washington, D.C., born in 1993 and at the present a resident of New York. Intifigis Visueta is the head of the Boulanger Initiative's Gender Diversity Council, where they work to promote music composed by women and non-binary people and to achieve greater inclusivity in new music. Figis Visueta brings with their music their view as a composer of color working within and attempting to change the social hierarchies of predominantly white institutions and experiences of racism and transphobia. They say of this work, quote, "A Bridge Between Starshine and Clay is a piece that underlines the intersections between the binaries that create in connecting interactions between left and right hands, low and high registers, or performer and instrument. Those binaries are revealed to be false, a bridge that joins but also dissolves." End quote. That was pianist Cristina Valdez performing an excerpt from A Bridge Between Starshine and Clay by Inti Figgis Vizueta, a non-binary Quechua Latinx composer from Washington, D.C. Recently, a group of Asian American musicians from Northwest Arkansas got together to create a video in collaboration with Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art and the University of Arkansas Asian Pacific American Employee Impact Group as a remembrance and tribute to the recent victims of violence in Atlanta. Violinist Ergin Kang says about this production, quote, "We came together overwhelmed by the March 16 Atlanta shooting, looking for ways to channel and ultimately sublimate our complex emotions through music. In recognition of the women, mothers, sisters whose lives were senselessly and prematurely taken, and the quiet, often unacknowledged sacrifices taken to create a home for themselves and others, we dedicate this musical tribute and remembrance," end quote. Let us listen to the Korean folk song Omaya Nanaya, Dear Mother, Dear Sister, performed by the ensemble Hansori. Moon Suk Park, soprano, Ergin Kang, violin, Hannah Waldo, viola, Dominic Na, cello, Hyun Kim, piano, in an arrangement by June Park. That was a Korean folk song, Amaya Nanaya, Dear Mother, Dear Sister, performed by the ensemble Hansori. Moon Suk Park, soprano, Ergin Kang, violin, Hannah Waldo, viola, Dominic Na, cello, Hyun Kim, piano, in an arrangement by Jun Park. All members of the University of Arkansas Asian Pacific American Employee Impact Group and many faculty at the University of Arkansas Music Department. This was a tribute and a remembrance to the recent victims of violence in Atlanta. Musicians raising their voices and instruments and using them as a valiant tool of resistance. These past weeks have been hard in our communities, still and once again grieving. I am thankful for music, musicians, audiences, advocates, giving up space, holding space, amplifying voices, uplifting. Let us build bridges, no walls. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter.
Classical music can be heard on 91.3 KUAF every Sunday through Thursday night, beginning at 8 o'clock after the evening edition of Ozarks at Large. And you can hear classical music at any time of day by going to KUAF2. You can find our classical music around-the-clock station at KUAF.com by asking your smart speaker to please play KUAF2, or by just tuning in to KUAF2 on your HD radio at home or in your car.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Dr. Kathleen Wong, providing in-office ketamine infusion therapy for treatment of depression and anxiety disorders. Following NIMH protocol, ketamine therapy is an effective alternative when other treatments fail. Located in Fayetteville, 935-9707 or drwongketamine.com for more information.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Sandridge. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas and Ozarks at Large. Is a production of KUAF. Contributors for our Thursday show this week included Jacqueline Froelich and Leah Uribe. Today's entire show and today's Sound Perimeter produced by Timothy Dennis in his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling, part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. Additional material for today's show provided by our friends and colleagues at KUAR, Public Radio for Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for being with us. Talk to you again soon.